Welcome to FW Presents Panel by Panel, the show that dissects a single comic book panel from the last 85 years of comics history, each episode. I'm Siskoid, and our panelist today is the host of the Done in One Wonders podcast, Wonder Show. I think I got it right. Zoom Yukinori. Hi, Zoom.
Hello, Michel. How are you?
Good. Did I get it right? There's so many words in that title.
Yes, you did. Actually, it was formerly known as Perez the Thought, in which it would actually go through a Perez comic book story panel by panel. Gee, I wonder where you got your idea from.
Well, I had my idea before.
Of course you did.
Yeah, no, it was always going to be the Batman panel by panel that we did for the April 1st show.
Which was a wonderful collaboration with you, by the way. Thank you for letting me be a part of that.
Great fun from everyone. I think you were one of the most frequent collaborators on that with lots of show ideas. And I remember, I remembered later, that's right, the Perez show that you'd proposed way back when at the start of your tenure at Fire and Water.
And which you guest starred in for a 3-minute segment.
And in that show, you proposed, well, it seemed like a joke.
Yes, it was.
Now we're doing it for real, but at the time, it seemed like a joke where, let's talk about George. And we didn't pull a George Perez today, but I think we got something good anyway. Mm. So you never had any intention of doing a Perez panel by panel?
Not beyond that 3-minute segment that we did as kind of a joke promo for Done in One Wonders.
Okay. Still, it seems like someone could.
Oh, yes.
We're sort of proving it with this, with panel by panel. Let's get into it. Let's roll up our random panel for the day, or we already did, but, so you could look at it for a couple days before.
Well, I'm informing my past self from 2 days ago of what comes up. So please just spin it so I can let him know.
All right. So the randomized series of choices, using my database of available comic book materials, either physical or digital, prior to the recording, we rolled up the year, the month, a comic on the stands or available online that month, a page, and finally a panel. And in this case, we rolled the year, 2013. It's close. The month of May. And among all the comics out that month, the revolving finger falls on an online comic release, Man of Steel, the prequel. Story by David S. Goyer, Jeff Johns, and Zack Snyder.
Never heard of them.
No. Script by Sterling Gates and art by Jerry Ordway.
Ooh, him I know.
Page 2 of 39. And we need a panel. It will be panel 2 of 3. Which you'll find in the show notes at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Going there now.
All right. So, are you surprised at the randomizer's pick, Zoom?
I am, actually. One, this is a Jerry Ordway comic that I do not own.
I don't know if there's a physical copy, if they ever made them or distributed them in cinemas or comic book shops, because it is still a 38-page, 39-40-page comic. So it's pretty thick to be a giveaway.
And it looks like it's penciled and inked by Mr. Ordway.
There are several inkers listed on the credits page. I'm not sure which inker this would actually be attributed to.
I will have to track this down, even though, well, The Man of Steel was a good science fiction movie. It just didn't feel like a Superman movie to me. But then I was not the target audience. But I will definitely track this down just for the artwork.
Just to give a small, very small, we don't use context here, but to give people a little bit of context about this odd comic. It is a prequel to the Man of Steel movie by Zack Snyder. It features, among other characters, but mostly Supergirl or Kara Zor-El. She'll be in the panel that we're looking at.
Oh, is that who that is?
That is, yeah.
Oh.
And so the comic sort of explains how that spaceship, that Kryptonian scout ship, gets there in the Arctic in the movie, as to what happens to Supergirl or to Kara in that timeline. Unknown. Is she meant to have survived that? Is she meant to have died because Zack Snyder? Unknown.
Man of Steel 2 will answer that question if it ever comes out.
Perhaps. I mean, they went to the trouble to do a comic in which even the director and the scriptwriter for that movie had a hand in crafting the plot. But of course, they got Sterling Gates, who is a renowned and beloved Supergirl writer of the last 20 years, to do the script, at least. So if you read the whole thing, it's not especially Snyderistic.
Right. Well, I'm glad you pointed out who that was, because I was going to give her a name, Lucinda. Because she has an L on her chest. I mean, it looks like an S, but she says it's an L, so I'll just take her word for it. I think maybe they just want to mess with their minds.
There's also DevM is in there, and I mean, they. So there are a couple of, you know, name checks of Kryptonians or Kryptonian-related characters that we know from the comics adapted for this. But let's talk about, that's enough of that 40-pager. Let's look at the panel itself. That's all we care about here at Panel by Panel, the discrete unit of comic book storytelling. So in this case, it is a horizontal panel. You want to describe it to us? There's quite a lot of detail.
I'll do what I can. It's very epic, very widescreen with its horizontal layout. But it shows five intrepid explorers who are dressed like extras in the Man of Steel movie. And they've obviously wandered off the film lot because they were trudging their way through an alien jungle. One of these five explorers, of course, is the blonde-haired humanoid female with the Superman S on her chest. So she calls it an L, and that must be Kara Zor-El. So I will not call her Lucinda, as I originally planned. One of the male explorers in the front, holding an oddly cut blade, which I presume he was using as a scythe, wipes his sweaty brow and says, "I've never understood why the council thinks this is a good test for pilots, or why we have to wear these itchy suits." And of course, Kara Zor-El, the blonde female explorer in the midground, responds, "We're simulating the harsh and unpredictable conditions Explorer Guild members potentially encounter, Kel. There's no telling what we could find before the terraforming begins." And this is just wonderfully drawn. That's all I can say. Do you have anything to add to the description?
There's another explorer much more in the foreground who's a bit dead-faced. It is cinematic because if we just took these as stills from the film,
right,
then there are some people who wouldn't be expressing for the camera. They'd just be, you know, in the foreground or the background.
Well, I think she is kind of expressing for the camera. I mean, if you take a look at that, the way she's got her eyebrows and just that little dimple on the left side of her mouth, she's just about to roll her eyes, I think. She has that look on her face like, oh boy, this guy again. Like responding to the uncomfortable Kel. Kel obviously complains a lot. He looks like a guy who would complain a lot. Just by his body language, which again is another amazing amazing quality of Mr. Ordway's artwork.
What can you tell us about the craftsmanship here? Because you're an artist. You know what's going on better than I do.
Shall we count the number of lines, sir?
Please.
No. There are 36 on the scythe, by the way. But anyway, well, Mr. Ordway himself, he's just a master draftsman. There are a number of incredible comic book artists that are wonderful storytellers, and they have a dynamic style. But there are not too many that actually, well, just really know how to illustrate. And Mr. Ordway is one of them. He's a master of depicting human emotion in his characters. There are other examples where even when, you know, when a real person has this emotion of great anguish, it makes them look kind of ugly in real life. Jerry Ordway will actually depict characters that look ugly when they cry, as the expression goes. And yet they're still on model. They still look like the character. They don't look like a completely different person. And that's something that even incredibly skilled artists like Neil Adams does not always pull off. So Mr. Ordway is indeed truly extraordinary. But just going to this panel here, even without reading the word balloons, I could tell that Kel on the left looks very uncomfortable. And just the position of his hand and the body language, that's another strong feature of Mr. Ordway's art. He can take these static images and yet they convey a sense of motion without the use of motion lines. I can actually see the movement of Kel wiping his brow. And the positions of the other characters and the body language, I can truly get the sense that these pilot explorers are trudging their way with difficulty through this harsh alien jungle. It's all just wonderful. And just the jungle itself, I like how the plants, they look familiar and yet they don't, because they're alien plants. So that kind of adds to the realism of that fantastic setting. Now, I can't go into the coloring very well because of my partial color blindness, but maybe you can comment on that for the folks at home.
Sure. Well, the sky is orange here. So we are on an alien planet or an alien environment, at least, with orange skies. You know, the plants are mostly green. I mean, it could be a jungle here if not for the stranger plant that's behind Kel. Well, it looks like maybe it could be some sort of undersea plant or anemone.
Yeah, with a cactus look to it too. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's huge and has little pink flowers at the tips. The tree in the middle, the shapes remind me of something like broccoli, mm-hmm. but a more ochre kind of look.
It's Dr. Seuss's broccoli.
Oh, very much so. I mean, those are the kinds of shapes that we see here. Dr. Seuss is not a bad comparison. And there are some mushrooms growing on the trunk of that tree. In the background is a bigger, maybe a thicker trunk tree, but still with some mushrooms. So this would be a very wet and hot, humid environment, probably, if it corresponds to anything here on Earth. And Kel, for example, is very warm here. He's sweating profusely.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure the suit is itchy for other reasons. There seems to be like, you know, there's like a barbed wire going from under the armpit kind of thing.
Yeah, those are like the backpack straps. And those backpacks look heavy. They're all leaning forward. So they all look a little bit weighed down by those packs, which is, again, just wonderful.
And there's really some shading. Kara is obviously in a spot of sunlight. There's some shade on her eyes. The orange sky behind her becomes white. It's blown out white towards the horizon, which gives her a bit of a halo, especially with the blonde hair. So she pops out of the image. She's the one we look at immediately when we look at this composition. Mm. The people in the foreground are more in shadow, probably under the canopy of trees. Similarly, the people in the background have some shading to them.
Yeah. And I like how one is looking off to the side, you know, just, you know, all the explorers are looking in kind of different directions, which is great.
As far as the coloring job goes, and even the way you look at some of the plants, and even the penciling is in color, is not a black line.
Mm.
In particular around the canopy of trees that's just behind Kel's word balloon, that is not a full dark line. I don't know. So there are some effects there that...
Well, I think they probably do a surprint to pull from the Who's Who terminology. Or the digital colorist probably just shifted the colors of the line work in addition to the colors. And it looks lighter to me. So it kind of creates that sense of depth, just like how things in the background would tend to be kind of out of focus. But these are still clearly drawn. They didn't fade them like some computer colorists do, which makes it very distracting. Here, it looks like it's in the background. It looks a little paled out, but you can still see it, and it's not distracting you with this, you know, camera blur effect that other colorists tend to do.
And this isn't a splashy kind of image the way that we've seen in, you know, in past episodes of Panel by Panel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a plane blowing up. It's not a Kerpow moment.
No.
I mean, it has a function, and that function is show the characters, and they're going to info dump here a little bit. So
a little.
For the artist, well, a little, yeah. For the artist, it's knowing that you're going to have a lot of dialogue on this page and leave room for that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's still very, very detailed.
Oh, it is. And it's very engaging. It's very engaging. You can actually, again, with the combination of the body language and everything, hear how these words are coming out. And you're like there in the scene. And there's a little bit of foreshadowing because it's like, I never understood why this would be a good test. Well, I think we're going to find out in later panels.
Probably. Yeah, because even if we just look at this, if I hadn't talked about the context, and you didn't know the context, right? You didn't check the context.
No. I knew it was a Man of Steel thing. And it was like, wow, Jerry Ordway drew a Man of Steel thing? Because they all look like they walked off the Man of Steel lot, as I said. So,
could you infer anything from what little dialogue we have here? What did you think the story was going to be about?
I presume it was going to be the backstory of Supergirl, because when I saw the Man of Steel movie, it was implied that that ship had like these pods with dead bodies in them, except for this one pod that was open. And there was a lot of fan theory that that was Supergirl in that pod, which would make her hundreds of years old, to be honest. So
So
I'm not quite sure how that works. But then Kryptonians have been known to be long-lived in the comics, depending on who writes it. So we'll have to see. But yeah, I wasn't sure how the story was going to go, to be honest. I still don't. I just know that the pilot doesn't think he should be there. So I think there's probably going to be something that would happen later that would justify the pilot being there. But other than that, I really don't know. But at least I'm engaged enough to want to know more, to want to read the next panel and find out.
To me, what this evokes is that a little bit of Kryptonian society that we don't really know much about, that they were in this particular universe, the DCEU. Kryptonians are not closed off from the rest of the world. They are explorers. They're also terraformers. Maybe they're, you know, they don't go to places and leave them be. It puts like a, like, I think words coming out of Supergirl's mouth, or the person we know as Supergirl. It seems like we take what she says as a positive, just because we know her and like her. But in reality, it's like a dark thing where they have an Explorers Guild. This guild is all about, well, they say guild, but I don't know. They don't all have the same symbol. I guess the symbols are families, not necessarily guilds, right?
Right. It's my name is L.
L. And these other ones that we don't know are other letters, I guess.
Mirst and Mirth.
Kel later is Kel-Er. So that's a U-R. That's probably an Er. I don't know about the other ones. That's the only one I caught just like flipping through quickly. I don't want to give myself too much context either. Yeah, that guild goes out, explores, and then terraforms.
And I remember terraforming from the movie. That's not a good thing.
No. So Supergirl, if she'd lived her whole life as an explorer, you know, if Krypton doesn't blow up, then maybe she's responsible for what we'd consider a negative impact on other planets.
Yes.
But her coming to Earth, if she does, if she made it, if she survived, if she's the one that came out of the pod, even this comic is ambiguous about her fate.
Oh, well, thanks for spoiling and not spoiling it for me, sir.
Well, it's not. You reminded me about that empty pod. That's not really in this comic per se. We can either think that she, at the end of the story, she's out of the story for good, or that it sets her up for showing up in later movies. But we're a long way away from Man of Steel now. You know, there feels like she should have been a bit more, I don't know, teased. But, you know, the movies are a bit of a mess.
Yeah, well, there's probably some untapped potential there that just did not. And maybe that was part of the reason why they did this prequel comic, too, to kind of set up interest for that, at least among the comic book fans that would read it, unless they did. I don't know if, well, like you said, you don't know if there was a printed version or not, so.
No, I'm not too sure, because it doesn't really have a real cover or anything. Yeah. Oh, I just noticed the suits have, like, little drinking taps, pipes, or, you know, next to the collar.
Is that what those are? Okay.
I think so. I think they're little spouts.
I seem to remember seeing things like that in the movie. I thought they were an atmospheric thing, but maybe they are drinking things, because they're not sealed. They don't have sealed helmets here.
No.
Like they did in the movie, so...
Maybe that's just my impression, because there are people walking in the jungle, and I'm thinking, right. You know, they're like the Fremen trying to survive, and their suits recycle their sweat, yeah.
Well, it's better than having beer hats on, I suppose. The little straws like that. And now that I think about it, I think in the Man of Steel movie, those little tubes actually went into their nostril, so that they can kind of breathe directly and not have to kind of turn their head and take a sniff.
You remember that movie much better than I do.
I have this eidetic memory thing.
So you can never forget Man of Steel. It's a boon and a curse.
A bit. Again, it's a good science fiction movie. It's a good movie for what it is. And I'm not going to try and make it a movie that it's not. Let's put it that way. That makes it easier for me to live with the memory.
My own reaction was not entirely negative. I felt it was a flawed film. But there's a lot of things in it that I did enjoy, including the Kryptonian stuff. A lot of people were turned off by, you know, that vision of Krypton, the gray metal shavings, you know, magnet version of Krypton. But I liked it. And I would, you know, if somebody told me, oh, they're doing a Jor-El movie next year, I would have gone.
Well, they did a Krypton series, I understand, on the Sci-Fi Channel. And in fact, there's a season two.
I saw the first one. I saw the first episode of that. It's not really in the same style as Man of Steel's Krypton, but it takes place like decades earlier.
It's Grandpa L, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Grandpa L, and then Adam Strange shows up as a time traveler, Zeta beaming to the past to save.
Oh, because that always happens.
To save Superman's future. I only saw the one episode. I think, you know, Brainiac's in it or whatever. So, I mean, if it made it to the second season, it's at least as good as any other DC-related show.
Yeah, if I ever catch up on the other DC shows I want to watch, I'll probably eventually get to it and see for myself.
I'm in the same boat. I'm at least one or two seasons behind on everything. So, any last thoughts on this one panel?
No, I don't think so. I think we covered quite a bit. Thank you for covering the color work. Your expertise on color wheel came in very handy here, sir.
I was only the host of that. I was not the one spotting the colors. But it all comes back to that one show on April 1st. So if you haven't listened to that, folks.
It all comes back to canceled podcast Cavalcade.
Yeah. Well, then if there's nothing more to say at this point, I'll thank you and ask you to tell the good people what you're working on right now.
What am I working on? Well, on the network, as you said, I host the Done in One Wonders podcast, Wonder Show, which spotlights a number of my favorite comic book stories that managed to be contained in a single issue. They tend to be around the Bronze Age DC Comics so far. I have a very special guest arriving on the show that will drop on June 7th. And there will be two more episodes left in the second season that will tie up the background storyline that was involving two other people in the Zoom crew that I'm not really supposed to know about. So we'll find out how that goes. I also host the Zoom for Sam podcast on the Fire and Water Records feed, which celebrates my joy of pop and Eurodance artist Samantha Fox by spotlighting a single every single episode.
The fourth episode dropped not too long ago.
That's right. It talked about Dreams Unfold. The fifth episode will be pulling quotes from the Bard himself. And I have also just finished recording my lines for the first script of Supersonic Pod Comics, which are essentially a new universe of superhero comics presented as audio dramas. And it's a very, very cool concept. And I have a nice, juicy character role that I'm just starting to sink into. So more to come on that. Not related to Fire and Water Network, by the way.
No, so we'll stay tuned. I guess you'll be announcing it on your shows when it's ready.
Yes, my understanding is that they're supposed to be launching weekly later this year.
So we'll keep an ear out for those. I'll let you go back to the margins, as I do.
The white space.
Yes, the white space in between. So we'll listen to a short promo, and then I'll come back with people's comments on our previous episode.
Very cool. Professor Zoom Yukinori led an ongoing expedition through his favorite single-issue comic book stories from the Bronze Age of DC Comics. With unique celebrity guest perspectives to set this program apart from other comic book review podcasts.
Solomon Grundy, don't understand.
Entity Terra Man.
I'm not following either.
Bizarro, totally get it.
I intend to participate in your podcast show of wonders.
As if I wasn't nervous enough.
Little Professor Man, mansplaining again.
Accessing files.
Experience the wonder.
Bizarro, what in tarnation did you do?
Adios, partner.
Me am Bizarro Terra Man.
Goodbye.
Of the Done in One Wonders podcast Wonder Show.
Watch out, you square brain varmint.
Only on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Now, your comments on the previous episode, which had Ange and me talking about a panel from All Winners Comics number 10 from 1943, a Wizard story, and a panel in which Wizard does not appear. Chris Franklin says, fun episode, fellas, and congrats on covering a Wizard story and never once mentioning his yellow costume and his mongoose-inflicted origin. The prop plane looks like an autogyro, a helicopter plane hybrid used by both The Shadow and Batman in his early days. Adds to the Golden Age ambiance. And maybe that swastika's bleeding? Just a thought. Keep them coming. These are a lot of fun. Robert Kelly says, like you guys, I didn't like Frank Robin's work as a kid. Now I absolutely love it. I think it's natural when you're younger to have a more narrow view of what comics, or superhero comics at least, should look like. And Robin's is so different from that. And while we did mention Robbins in the show, of course, he didn't pen the panel in question. All we really knew was the inker was Bob Oxner. Martin Gray says, thanks for another great dose of art admiration. It's always great to hear Ange. I reckon I've bought archives from that very same book and record store he mentions. It was tough not to buy loads of stuff. Martin takes me to task on my comment that a plane in a cave is bizarre. He says, holy forgetfulness. Of course, there is a plane in the Batcave. And he also says, this is an interesting panel, tougher to visually parse out of context. I especially love the caption's slanting font. Sometimes I contort my body weirdly at work and yell, help, I've been italicized. Surprisingly, few people laugh. Great call on the Scooby-Doo-ness of the villains, though I am pretty sure the Skrulls have been retrofitted into the Golden Age. So what's next? Well, you've heard what's next. But after this one, Martin, it's going to be a panel from your neck of the woods. I won't say more. And Ward Hill Terry says, I'm really loving this show. This time I didn't see the panel before the discussion, so I was trying to imagine it based on your description. I wasn't very close. I love the idea that one could see the stalactites as the sky. This is really a very good example of the effective and efficient economy of comic book illustration. The figures are in silhouette, yet indicate strangeness and malevolence. The microphone and stand are a negative silhouette. It clearly shows that this is a microphone on a stand. The aircraft, and I concur with Chris, that's probably an autogyro, indicates the scope and vastness of the setting. With this one little panel, the reader sees three scary creatures with technological capabilities and transportation. With all of that taken care of, now we can focus on the story. Well said, Ward Hill Terry. So as ever, a reminder that if you'd like to do one of these short podcasts, drop me a line and we'll arrange it. You'll be handed a comic book panel randomly and we'll put it up for discussion. My thanks to my guest, Zoom Yukinori, and now, once again, the panel is opened.